Toronto. We're on the air coast to coast as well through our syndicates, Vancouver, BC to St. John's, Newfoundland. And you are listening to Canada's Environmental News Hour. I am joined once again by my co-host today, Kevin Farmer.
Good morning. Hi, Darren.
And we've got a really jam-packed show for you again today here. I'm continuing with my new trend of trying to jam-pack as much spongy goodness into one show as I possibly can, possibly because I miss Twinkies. Who knows? We'll figure out that during the show. However, first off, my guest today is going to be Kathy Vackel, who's going to be discussing an article that was in Now Magazine, as well as making its round on the CAPE listserv, which is talking about why the nuclear industry is blowing off low-level radiation health findings. That's the name of the Now Magazine story. We'll be talking to Kathy right after this intro about that. Second up, we're going to be back with Gordy Warnoff, who's the host of Junk Raiders. That's right. You may remember his name from Junk Raiders on Discovery Canada. He's going to be talking to us a little bit after the first guest. And then later in the program as well, we're also going to be speaking to Ron Seifert, who's down in Texas, actually. He is organizing, or at least the media representative for some groups that are organizing opposition to the Keystone XL pipeline. We wanted to get a bit more of a southern U.S. Effect on this. We talk a lot about southern Ontario. We talk a lot about Washington and the northern U.S. Reaction to this. First time I've actually heard of protests making it all the way down to the very, very southern end of the U.S. So we're going to be talking to Ron at the end of the program to get sort of their perspective on this and get an update on the protests that have been happening down there. There's some hunger strikes and a few other things going on. We'll be hearing from him right at the end of the program. Kevin and I are also going to be discussing throughout the program here and there a little bit some of the developments already that have been happening in Doha. So stay tuned for that. And interspaced in between all of that, of course, is our music is now programmed by the Open Till Midnight blog. So thank you very much once again to all the music selections today by DJ Amber Waves providing that. You can actually check the website after the show for a number of reasons. One of them, though, is that she's been writing us individual track reviews for each individual song, for everything that she gives us. So if you're interested in any of the music that you hear today, not only can you go and get track information on the website afterwards, but she's also done us the courtesy of having individual song reviews for each of the songs that we're playing today. So very, very cool stuff. Go and check out Open to Midnight blog. However, well, let's get right started right now. I believe I have Kathy on the line. Dr. Kathy Vackel, are you there?
Yep.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
You're welcome.
So I saw the original article in Now Magazine, but it sort of caught my attention again when it came across my desk in the form of the Canadian Physicians for the Environment, Canadian Association for Physicians for the Environment listserv. So we got you on to talk about it a little bit today. You are a former or current on the board of directors for CAPE?
Right.
Current, actually, I believe, yes. And then you're also with a group called Physicians for Global Survival. You're going to be participating with the public hearings next week for Darlington Nuclear Reactor Refurbishment, as well as having authored a number of literature reviews on pesticides, urban sprawl, and nuclear energy. So you have a bit of expertise on this topic. In what way do you think the nuclear industry and by association the government is ignoring science on the issue of nuclear power?
Well, The Darlington hearings are looking at the environmental assessment that has been done, which has a remarkable little coverage of the health issues. And as a physician, of course, that's my concern. Every stage of the nuclear industry emits radioactivity into the air, water, and soil, from the uranium mining to refining at Port Hope. And anyone that's followed that knows that there's widespread radioactive contamination of the town of Port Hope. But also the chronic low-level ongoing emissions coming out of reactors. And from the beginning, the nuclear industry has downplayed these emissions and saying they're far too low to be causing illness in anybody, particularly those living close by. And in the environmental assessment, they completely gloss over it and just say these are minuscule and not causing illness in anybody. However, since the 80s, particularly in the UK and Europe, there have been concerns about childhood leukemia in children living near reactors, and a number of studies have been done, some of which have been equivocal, many of which have shown a relationship, and quite more recently in the last few years, a couple of studies coming out of Germany and recently out of France have shown, with very robust methodology, studies that have shown increased risk of young children living within 5 kilometers of reactors. In Canada, we basically have not really studied this, and we're even at more risk than most other places, because unlike most countries who build their reactors in mostly rural areas, we've built our reactors, most of them, in the most populated area of the whole country. So this has big implications for people living around Darlington and Pickering reactors. And this is not being addressed, which is why this article came out, and this is why I want to make this known by attending the hearings and doing a presentation.
One of the things that really, really interests me is that, I mean, for those of us that are sort of paying attention to this sort of thing, this is definitely not a new issue. I mean, there's entire groups. We've had them on several times. There's more than one. Stop Nuclear Power in Ontario, community groups that are specifically targeted at Ontario, dealing with Ontario's nuclear. There's a lot of information floating around, but it never seems to get any traction. Am I getting the wrong feeling on that? Do you feel like you're making progress on this issue?
I totally agree with you, and I think the Ontario government has been very successful, being very pro-nuclear, at, as I said, glossing over these issues, not addressing them, and in fact presenting nuclear energy as clean and green, which it is anything but. And the health issues that I'm speaking of are completely under the radar, and most people have no idea about this, even in the medical community. And certainly the nuclear industry is well aware of these, from these groups that you've been mentioning, but it never seems to make it into any kind of mainstream news.
One of the other things that that I noticed recently as well was that, there was an article that came across, I think just in the past couple of days, talking about how Tim Hudak, the Conservative Party leader here in Ontario, who's going to be running shortly, the election will be underway in the next little while, he was proposing that we actually cancel all these nuclear plants and then import our energy from hydro from Quebec and other places and from the East Coast, which seems like on its face, I'll admittedly haven't had the time to dig into exactly what his proposal was, so I don't know the dirty details. But this seems like a good idea, and the reason I came across it was that one of the anti-nuclear newsletters that we receive, one of the hundreds of newsletters that we're on, was saying that we should support Tim Hudak's idea. Now, we don't have a political position on this show, but it is rare to be sort of championing an idea from a Conservative Party at any level. Do you agree that in case from what you know that Tim Hudak is on the right path with this? Is that a good alternative to reinvesting in Darlington?
Well, I'm not familiar with his comment, which is kind of surprising because he's been extremely pro-nuclear all along and has actually threatened to cut renewable energy. I don't know the ins and outs of his suggestion, although it may well be to do with money, because one of the problems with nuclear energy is that it's so astronomically expensive, and these refurbishments and rebuilds and builds usually go 2 to 2.5 times the predicted cost, which is already high, and they always take years longer to get online, if ever. So I suspect and I'm guessing that it's to do with money, and that's a good enough reason for me. I think it would be great if we would cancel all the nuclear reactors, phase them out as soon as possible, and use other sources. Of course, it depends what other sources he's referring to, so I can't really comment on that because I don't know, but I would be all in favor of any policies to phase out nuclear energy.
Okay. Well, again, to be fair, this literally came out yesterday. I'm not super familiar with it as well, so maybe we should stay away from that until I know a little bit more. But going with that thought, then, what would you propose? We're going to shut down Darlington. They're proposing reinvesting in it because it's at the time when they either need to shut it down or reinvest, is my understanding. But either way, we need an alternative. So, putting Tim Hudak's possible suggestion aside, what is the alternative? What are you proposing?
Well, I'm not proposing anything. I'm a family doctor who's interested in health. I'm not really an economist or an energy specialist. But I do know that, and it just makes perfect sense, the first thing we need to do is conserve energy. And there have been many proposals from the Pembina Institute, David Suzuki Foundation, as to very quickly we can reduce our electricity consumption, probably all energy consumption, by 50%. And right now, 50% is what nuclear energy is the percentage of energy used or electricity provided in Ontario is nuclear. So right away, if we did that, we wouldn't need that. So I think probably, as most people have said, a combination of renewable energies, perhaps a transition from coal through natural gas. I don't really know much about that, but people have proposed that for the base load. Mm-hmm. There are many, many proposals on this, but we can certainly do without nuclear energy, and many, many countries in the world do, and other provinces in Canada do.
So last question, we're running out of time, but the last question I've got for you has to do with people's absorption of information. As I said, this is by far not the first time we've covered nuclear energy in Canada or in Ontario on this program. And as we discussed at the beginning of the interview, this has been an ongoing issue with lots and lots of groups putting lots of energy into putting information about this and how dangerous it can be, low-level radiation health. I mean, you could fill a room with studies on this issue, and yet it doesn't seem to permeate into the public. And as you said, you know, the government's, in your opinion, done a good job preventing the public from being aware of this. But to what degree do you think that it affects that, just because this is such a complicated issue, that it's maybe difficult to convince the public because it's so complicated? Like, what way do you think that the simple complexity of the idea has to do with why the public isn't aware of it?
I think that's one reason. I think nuclear energy is really hard to understand. When I became familiar with this, I started looking into this a few years ago because I was concerned about climate change, and a lot of the talk was that the answer to climate change is nuclear energy, and somehow it doesn't sit right. In, you know, it's sort of intuitively, you know, radioactivity, little that I knew about it sort of didn't feel right. But when I started to look into it, it became very clear how dangerous it is. But it is very complicated. And if what most people's information source is the media, it really, again, the health coverage isn't covered very well. And I also think that some things just take time. It took 40 years to get tobacco, the tobacco industry to task about effects of, you know, health effects of that. We're getting somewhere with pesticides, but it's taken a long, long, long time. That started to be an issue with back Silent Spring back in the 60s. So this is going to take time. Unfortunately, you're right. The decision has to be made very soon about Darlington, and I'm certainly hoping that the public will listen. And it isn't just the low-level chronic emissions. It's the risk of accident, which is always there. And after Fukushima, which is still going on, and that has not been in the media much, but that disaster is still going on. the risk of accident, the problem with this highly toxic radioactive waste, for which no one worldwide has ever figured out what to do with. It's just sitting 40,000 tons of it at the reactor sites just outside Toronto. We still don't know what to do with it. And there's proposals of burying it deep in the Canadian Shield. Of course, nobody has any idea how safe that is and what if that gets out into the Great Lakes or people's groundwater. It's far too high a risk. And then the cost itself is astronomical. So there are many, many reasons to be concerned health-wise about this. And I agree it's a complicated issue, and we're also told that we need nuclear energy because we need all this electricity, and that it's all this talk about needing the base load, but other countries manage and other provinces manage just fine without it.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Kathy Vackel. Do you have any web resources or any information that you'd like to direct our listeners to?
Well, on the CAPE website, there is a pretty good review of the whole health effects of the uranium mining and nuclear industry. You can just look on the CAPE website, and you should be able to find it there.
Okay, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're
going
to welcome.
Go to a music break now, and we'll be back to hear from Gordy Warnoff, the host of Junk Raiders from Discovery Canada, right after this.
I swear to show.
right, and we are back. I'm going to be joined by Gordy Warnoff in just a second. He's of Discovery Channel fame, Junk Raiders. I believe we have him on the line. Are you there, Gordy?
Hello, yes. Yes, is this Darren?
It is, in fact, Darren. How are you doing this morning?
I'm good. How are you, sir?
Very, very well. It's a pleasure to have you on the show today.
Oh, the pleasure's all mine.
You caught my attention because I'm an avid follower of Alternatives Journal, and you were, in fact, the cover story this time around. I guess, they're bi-monthly. I was about to say this month's issue. On this issue, how does it feel to be a cover story?
Oh, my. It's really something else, you know. I never thought I would be on the cover of a magazine, and it makes me think of that song, you know, about the cover of the Rolling Stone, but I know it's not. But
not quite. Well, Alternative Journal is getting there, but not quite Rolling Stone.
In the Canadian environmental scene, it kind of is equivalent, though, right?
Absolutely. I was excited to speak to you today because you've got quite a knack. I'm not really a proficient builder, but I do like messing around with tools. I do have a great appreciation for people who recycle things. And you are the, I believe, self-titled, if I can say so, Freecycler. Do you want to just talk a little bit about what freecycling is and what the approach is that you take to your business that you've also applied to your show?
Well, with the free cycling or like salvage building, as it could be called, basically it's just with things that you can find, whether, you know, basically they've been thrown out. That's kind of my gig, is like dealing with, like things that other people don't want, refuse, little orphan pieces, you know? So, I've just kind of collected things over the past couple of years and, you know, it's kind of like, it gets to be a little bit like hoarding, but you get a great deal of materials. And then, you know, I'm also like on the tools and building things and doing home renovations or cabinets or whatever. So then in my downtime in between like jobs, this is kind of how I started. You know, I'd build like, you know, say a couch out of an oil drum or, you know, an old extension ladder that I've used to work on a house, and then it gets bent and you can't really go up it safely anymore. So then I make it into a table or a chair or something like that. And so it's just kind of like finding these pieces, and then they're taking up room in my space. So then I got to make something out of them and sort of get them out of the space. And it's kind of like, you know, like the misfit toys or whatever on that Christmas, you know, there's like all this misfit stuff. And then I kind of like tweak it and give it a little boost, you know, a little facelift, and then turn it into a piece of furniture, a piece of art, or build it into somebody's home, and then it's, you know, it's back into circulation. It didn't get thrown out. So that's kind of how I like it, you know?
So that's actually one of the things that I wanted to ask you about. I'm taking a look off your website. There's some of the information about your business, A Higher Plane, and I'm looking there at some of the ways that you have a list of ways in which you take action, and it's things about, says you recycle 80% of your construction waste, and that you try and keep people's health in mind by staying away from the use of chemical products, and another one is that you're trying to use alternative construction methods and make it really built to last and not something that has planned obsolescence. Where my question is in that is that because this is so not the norm these days, because it is so rare to have items that are made out of, you know, that aren't soaked full of chemicals, that aren't completely made of like glue and really, really low grade press board.
Yeah.
How do you go about recycling things that when so much of it is bad to start with?
Well, when so much of it is bad to start with, it is trickier to recycle it. I mean, a lot of the work that I do on residential is older homes. And, you know, in my last, maybe say 5 years, you know, I've worked on maybe like two new homes and probably like 20 old homes where the studs are bigger. They're made out of probably first growth fur, stuff like that. And, you know, there's not a lot. I mean, there's asbestos in some of it, right? And so you call a guy and get it dealt with. But other than that, you know, you're dealing with, like, some of the lower technology builds back in the day. So in an old house, you can really pull a lot of materials out of there to recycle. As certainly the wood is spectacular, you know, it's full of nails from the lath and the plaster and stuff like that, But once you get the nails out, the growth rings are tight. Like, it's beefy wood that you can actually build something out of. It's not a flimsy little stick. They didn't have adhesives back then. So when you're pulling trim off, one thing that I'm doing right now, I'm in a house, and I pulled all the trim off. It's all nice oak, probably first growth trim. I'm in a house in Parkdale. The oak trees probably grew within the city, you know, back. It's a 100-year-old house. And so I pulled off all the trim, and it came off with no fuss, no cracking, because there was no adhesives. And so I'm just going to apply maybe some stripper or something like that. And even in that case, like, I have this great connection with sort of a biodegradable paint stripper, which is awesome. So you just apply it, it falls off, and you catch it all in newspaper, roll it up, throw it out. It's biodegradable. And then I'm going to reinstall all the same trim in the same house. So that part of it is really great. With the older houses, you can really, really reuse a lot of materials because there wasn't all this, you know, nonsense and stuff like that. Whereas in a new build, like, say, in a suburb, you know, everything's glued in place and there's formaldehyde and everything and it's off-gassing into your home, the carpets, the vinyl, all that stuff. But in an old house, there's no vinyl, there's no formaldehyde added to all the wood and stuff like that. So that is kind of where I found the most success in recycling, and that's fine with me. You know, I like old houses, so...
So that leads to another kind of logical progression of that, which is that we live, you know, there's obviously some people out there who appreciate what you're trying to do here, or also, you know, we wouldn't have enough support for our show. You know, there's obviously, you know, some people out there who are being conscious of these sorts of issues, but a lot of people are not. I mean, I think you'd agree with that. We're, you know, our economy and our culture in North America is very much based on a consumer culture. And a lot of the time in my experience, both, you know, in my own experience of my own life and also observing other people as well, is that a lot of the time, especially with bigger items, people decide to get new ones. Let's pick a coffee table. People decide to get a new one, not because their old one is broken, but because they've seen a new one that they like. Right. So it's not necessarily something that was garbage worthy. It could have probably very easily been salvaged if it was damaged or fixed, very easily repaired. But instead it goes out on the curb and maybe someone else picks it up. But I think a lot of the time, you know, that sort of thing ends up in the garbage dump. So how do we address that sort of an issue? Like, how do we address consumer culture when you, almost the material for you to use, as we were just saying, that, you know, the amount of stuff that you can easily fix and do in a sustainable way, in a healthy way, over time, we're losing all of those, and more of it's being replaced with IKEA. So how do we address that issue? How do we, you know, you're more interested in the building part, but I'm interested sort of in the activism part. How do you convince people that this is important?
Well, that is a tricky one, because even, you know, you mentioned coffee tables that are going out, but, like, a lot of the time, too, it's like a whole bathroom. Somebody just, their bathroom is out of date. The tiles remind them too much of the 90s, and then... The sink isn't the big bowl that sits on top. Those are very popular now. And so old sinks that are in the counter, just like regular that we grew up with, those are all being changed out because resale value of the house. And we need to update and have those bowl sinks and nice tiles. And that's all a style that's going in 10 years. That's going to be obsolete. And they're going to change those out. And I just, on that front, it's really frustrating. I mean, I don't really take a lot of work myself that is just cosmetic, you know. It's not something that I'm interested in, and I'm, you know, you kind of, people don't even want to hire me for that, you know, like, from my perspective. But back to the question is, how do we convince people? And I think there's a lot of fronts, you know, shows like your shows, magazines like Alternatives Journal, you know, Twitter seems really good for getting the word out about, climate change stuff and all of these environmental issues that are really, like, important, but maybe aren't on the, you know, they're not on the front burner because you've got Rob Ford screaming at a council meeting and that's, like, exciting news, you know? So that takes more of the spotlight, right? Like, environmental action and, like, changing our consumer habits isn't really that sexy, you know? But I think,
have you ever been, like, on a job? Like, say someone hired you to do one project and you're in their home working on something very specific and you've seen a bunch of other stuff and convinced them, like, you know, in a very personal sense, I guess, to get to the question in your personal experience. Have you ever been, like, in a house and brought someone over that they should be doing something else, or convinced them of something that they weren't planning on having you work on?
Well, you know, in terms of insulating, you know, natural light, you know, choosing like a good insulation option that's going to like really, you know, make their home more energy efficient and stuff like that. That's part of my job, is to know what is available and what we can do to retrofit a house to make it more energy efficient, or to make them some cabinets out of reclaimed wood that I have, you know, where they say, oh, I want like, you know, a dark wood and I want these cabinets. And I say, well, I don't have like a dark wood, but I have a bunch of reclaimed oak that I can stain dark, and I can make it match with, you know, what you've got, and I can give you a good price on it because it was reclaimed. And, you know, stuff like that, where it's maybe something that they're interested in, or, you know, in that case, or in the insulation case, where they're like, okay, I just want new, you know, I want the plaster mask down, I want drywall up, and then I say, okay, cool, let's do some, you know, some high-efficiency insulation in here to cut down on your heating bills. And, you know, that's always a good sell, you know, money, you know. So you say, it's going to cut down on your heating bills, it's going to make your house, you know, more energy efficient, and that is certainly good from a resale value perspective, you know, and sometimes you can even, you know, convince clients to do a blower door test before you start to see how energy efficient the house is to begin with, and then you do it again at the end, and you can then quantify sort of the savings or the energy efficiency of the place. So things like that, I'm pretty big on talking to clients, and like you say, there's not a lot of education out there. People want flat walls, they want pot lights, they want a cabinet that is as cheap as IKEA most of the time, you know. It's
until there's the next thing that they want that's different, you know.
Yeah, so this is tough. It is an uphill battle, but there's an appetite out there for these things as well, and I don't know if people necessarily even know about them, which is fair enough, because there's just so much information out there. And so, you know, I think if you can make it an attractive thing and make it something that appeals to people's aesthetic sense, then, you know, then you get a little deeper and it appeals to their pocketbook as well. And it appeals to all these different kind of emotions that people have, you know. It's going to save them money. It's going to make them feel good. It's made out of this first growth wood. You know, a lot of the furniture pieces I do have elaborate stories, you know, of like, this is a piece from a farm, from a guy. Like, for instance, I went on a salvage, just a friend of the family's out by Peterborough, where I'm from. But I live in Toronto now, but out by Peterborough, a friend of the family passed away, and he was the founder of the Peterborough Canoe Museum, which is Canada's national museum dedicated to canoes. And so he was a big canoe enthusiast, and he passed away last year, the year before, and his wife allowed me to sort of go through their farm and pick through the property. And he was a collector of antiques of all kinds, farm antiques, and he donated a lot to different sort of historical sites. But anyways, after all the donations and everything were done, I was allowed to go through and like pick a bunch of things and make an offer, and we made a little deal, you know. And so a lot of these really interesting obsolete farm pieces and little bits of equipment, I have all this stuff, and this guy has the Order of Canada, you know, like he's a great Canadian. And I've got all kinds of weird wooden farm pieces from, you know, in the bushes by his barn, and then making furniture out of that. That's really special for people that are interested in it, because they see it and they say, oh, that's a nice little table. And then you say, oh, I got all this wood from Kurt Whipper's place, and he has the Order of Canada, and he just passed away, and he's like a great man, you know?
Absolutely. So almost honoring the person through the renewal of his property.
Absolutely. Yeah, I know. Absolutely. It's kind of weird, right? But
I'm afraid we're actually, believe it or not, a couple of minutes over, but you've been so much fun to talk to, Gordy. I really appreciate you joining us on the program. I'm going to give you an extra 30 seconds because I have one fun question that I always reserve for my most entertaining guests.
Oh, my God.
And so I'm going to give you 30 seconds or less.
Okay.
I've asked this to people like Elizabeth May. I've asked this to Dr. James Hansen from the NASA Space Goddard Institute. You're the most recent recipient of this question. Are you ready?
Yes.
I need to know you're very environmental. Your whole business is based around recycling. I need to know what your worst environmental sin is, Gordy.
My worst environmental sin?
Get it off your chest live on the air.
Well, I don't always flush the toilet. I do. Sometimes I flush the toilet, like if it's yellow. Sometimes I don't even let it mellow. I just flush it. Not every time, but like sometimes, you know.
Well, I think that's water conservation. I'm not even sure that counts.
No, anyway. Well, like I flush too much. I'll fill it with yellow and then I'll flush. Sometimes, not every time, but sometimes, and I feel bad, but I just got to do it, you know.
All right. Well, we'll let you get away with that one. Thank you so much, Gordy Warnoff, for joining the program.
Okay.
And of
Thanks
course, check out the article in Alternatives Journal. Check out his business webpage as well, which is A Higher Plane. Very much our pleasure to have him on the air today. We're going to go to a music break now, and we'll be right back afterwards. Kevin Farmer is going to be jumping in. I'm going to have Leah jump in as well. Stay tuned.
I grew up in a small town of strangers, but I had a home. I walked the lane in the dark and the danger, but it's worth being alone. Truth and sky are bright tonight, and the cold keeps me sharp. Close my eyes, I'm alive, and the cold keeps me sharp.
We're back. I'm Darren Kaster. You're listening to The Green Majority. I've got Kevin Farmer and Leah Mazzolini in the studio. I just want to remind everyone to very big thank you to DJ Amber Waves from Open to Midnight Blog for providing today's music. As I mentioned at the top of the show, you can actually go, and not only do we have the track listing for all the information, but these are all local bands, either most of them from Toronto, some of them from Ontario, some of them from just across Canada, but it's all Canadian content we play on this show. Not only does Amber go and pick out the music for us every week now, but she actually writes specific reviews for each individual band and track that she gives us, which was posted with the post on the website. Another great reason to go and check out the website after the show is done. And as well, in addition to that, I was talking to Leah this morning. We have so much content. There's so much stuff. No one person could possibly read all the stuff that we put up on our Facebook and Twitter. It would be inhuman. I don't think even between the two of us we could do all of it.
No, there's just so much. So
a really good reason to do that. Of course, you can skim through everything. You don't have to read every article, but there's tons and tons and tons of stories. I think we could very easily do a 4-hour show.
Do
a 4-hour show. So all the stuff you're missing, and you know, we try and pick a combination of kind of the most important stuff and the most entertaining stuff, because we want to have a good entertaining show, but there's tons and tons of content. Definitely some really important stories that we just have to take a pass on every week, just because there literally isn't enough time. Or sometimes if we got to take a story because it's breaking news and we've got to cover it, we pass on some fun stuff that I would have otherwise liked to cover. So there's really just no way to do it. So until the station manager here gives us a 4-hour show, you're going to have to go ahead and sign up for our Twitter, which is at Green Majority. Check out the Facebook page. It's not just a sign up so that we know that you're paying attention to us, which is great because I'm a narcissist and I love to know that people are paying attention. It makes me happy. I go to sleep better. I smile more. But also there's a good reason for you to join those things. There's a lot of content we put up there. It really is worth your while to have a look at. Leah's going to give us a quick preamble. What are people missing today? What stories did we not have time to cover? Just if you want to run through them for us.
Yeah, thanks, Darren. Oil giant Chevron lands in a Toronto court over a pollution suit. CBC reports Alberta and Quebec are working on closer energy ties. A new BC Environment website makes scientific reports easily accessible. The Vancouver Sun says Environment Minister Peter Kent is asking Manitoba to take over a water pollution research lab. And Natural Resources Minister Joe Oliver says economic growth won't put the environment at risk. Over the border, the Heartland Institute are pushing to reverse renewable energy mandates. BP is being suspended from new U.S. federal contracts over the oil disaster. Europe's largest steel plant in Italy is badly damaged by a tornado during a protest surrounding pollution fears. The New York Times reports an oil royalties bill ignites a protest and divides parts of Brazil. And according to The Guardian, China's emissions are expected to rise until 2030, despite ambitious green policies. All these stories and more are posted on the Twitter feed at Green Majority.
Thank you very much, Leah. And that's that's just a sampling of some of the stuff up there. So really good reason to go add yourself to the Twitter, add yourself to the Facebook, go and check out the website, track information on the music, links to all the stories. If there's any videos, we'll put those up. We put links to everything we talk about on the show. All great reasons to go and check out our online resources. While you're there as well, we have a Help TGM section as well, where you can give us a little bit of information. Nothing personally identifiable, but just a little bit of demographic information is a good reason to contact the show, because we're able to target the show more to who's listening if we know you're there. So go and put your vote in for who you are so that we can more attune the show to you. And a great example of that is actually going to be our guest, Ron, who's coming up right at the end of the show, which was actually sent to me by Sean. I'm going to have to double check his last name, but Sean is listening from Italy, probably listening right now. Hopefully he's freaking out and going, oh my God, I'm on the radio. I don't know if he sounds like that. I'm just guessing. But yeah, he sent us an email. He said, hey, you should really cover something about this, the Keystone XL in Texas. Absolutely. I love responding to listener requests. So not only are we covering it today on the show, I got a live guest from Texas to talk about it. Great reason to contact us. The email is thegreenmajority@gmail.com. Send me an email. You can say hi. You can suggest a feature. You can do anything you like. Just keep the swearing to a minimum, I guess, just because it hurts my feelings. But other than that, you can write me, send me anything you like, compliments, insults, anything at all. We just love knowing that other people are out there paying attention at all. Kevin, we're going to go to you now, though. We mentioned a little bit about Doha, COP18 last week. We're going to run through it a little bit more today with you, and then we will likely have a guest on live to talk about from the ground from Doha next week. So stay tuned for that. In the meantime, Kevin, can you just give us a little bit of an update about some of the stories that have been coming out of Doha?
Well, as always, it boils down to managing expectations. The conferences of the parties have been, a continuing theater following the Kyoto Protocol. Still trying to settle questions that were raised with the initial conference on climate change, and what it's boiling down to consistently is a divide between developed and developing nations. So the crucial question, in a large sense, it boils down to the U.S. and China. So in a significant way, we have to bridge the gap between the expectations of developed and developing nations. And I think that, in fact, Doha, we'd be better off replacing Doha with a summit between China and the U.S. and just have them specifically try to come to terms with each other regarding emissions policies, because they're the 800-pound gorillas in the room.
Sure. And I could see some people being sort of upset at that proposal because, you're leaving all these other nations and the people who are most affected, arguably some of the nations that are most affected by climate change. But really, until we have the two biggest players in the room willing to even talk to each other, I would have to agree with you. And until they're talking to each other, it doesn't really matter what anyone else has to say.
And in fact, they typify both sides of they typify the two camps. They're representative of the two camps. What the developed nations are saying is that we won't sign on until developing nations, which are becoming significant polluters, also have to agree to binding cuts to emissions.
Which, to be fair, their argument is based on the idea that, hey, we're dealing with climate change now because all you guys got to industrialize, and now you're saying we can't industrialize.
Exactly.
So that's where they're coming from, which is completely legitimate point of view.
It is a completely legitimate point of view. They're saying that the existing, to be more specific, they're saying the existing inventory of greenhouse gases was put there by the developed countries, and they did that on their way to becoming rich and improving their quality, raising their standard of living, and so on. And they're saying, look, you reduce your emissions and let us industrialize. The problem is that when you're talking about taking a lifestyle that look at the OECD nations, and you say, look at the lifestyle of the developed countries, which might comprise about a billion people. The planet can't support us. If the world only consisted of the developed nations, the planet simply couldn't take the burden of the impacts of the wealthiest countries. we're already unsustainable. So to industrialize the rest of the world along the same model is just beyond a recipe for disaster. It's a non-starter. So what in my opinion we should be doing is we should be the developed nations have, in my opinion, an obligation to reduce their emissions to zero and revolutionize the energy economy into, you know, along green sustainable lines and start supplying developing nations with that technology. We can't support the rich nations. Our lifestyle has to change because the earth can't support us already. And we simply can't, you know, take, you know, a billion people from China and a billion people from India and other large developing economies like Brazil and say, we're going to take our lifestyle and export it to you where everyone has their own, you know, SUV and we live a consumer lifestyle. It just can't happen. Our lifestyles have to change, and the developed rich nations have an obligation to be pioneers in a new green sustainable lifestyle.
Well, I mean, I think you know how much I like comparisons and making things into stories. But I mean, it's almost like the idea of, you know, going and robbing a bank. And right. then but you stole so much money that by the time the cops show up and the guy who ran the bank who you robbed shows up with the cops, that you're so rich that you've already bought out the cops. You know what I mean? And they're like, well, too bad. We already have all the money. What are you going to do about it? I mean, that's essentially what happened because, I mean, we're talking about, you know, first world and developing nations and stuff like that. You know, a lot of the stuff that we've built, a lot of the industrialization that we've done, we weren't mining all of that. In some cases, we were. Canada's a good example of a resource economy. But, you know, it's not like all the, like, computers, great example. I'm forgetting the name of the metal is missing from my brain at the moment. But, I mean, almost all computer technology is based on this very rare metal, which can be almost exclusively only mined from Africa, or at least the world's largest reserves of it are from Africa. So without kind of veering off into socioeconomics outside of environment, you know, it's not just that we built up and now we're saying they can't. We built up by robbing of their resources, and now we're saying they can't do the same thing.
Exactly. If you look at it from if you try to parse the argument entirely from the point of view of economic equity or equality, it's a perfectly rational argument to tell developing nations to say, look, you eliminate your emissions first and we'll follow along later once we're also rich. It's a totally, on the face of it, it's a completely reasonable argument. The simple reality, though, is that the planet can't sustain it. We simply can't do this. And if we do, I took an environmental studies course at U of T a few years ago, and we actually ran simulations, computer simulations, on the industrialization of China, just China, mind you. And this was a few years ago. And back then, even the transformation between then and now of China's economy is already, like, incredibly hard to accept how rapidly it's advanced. But we ran simulations about the burden of pollution coming from the industrialization of China alone, and on the charts, it just blew up the graphs. It just blew them up. The burden of pollution coming from that industrialization, and in China, there's, you know, several hundred rivers that not only can you not drink from anymore, they're classified as you're not allowed to touch them. The burden of pollution being released by China's industrialization is, you know, even absent the greenhouse gases, is already, you know, toxic and unsustainable. So it's like I said, this simply can't happen. We need a hero to step up and pioneer a green sustainable lifestyle.
All right. Well, we're going to keep our fingers crossed that potentially our next guest could be that hero. Who knows? We're going to go to him now. And I just want to thank Sean. Sean, I apologize if I'm saying your name wrong, but Sean Hoban was the person who emailed us from Italy. So thank you very much for the suggestion. Because of that, I contacted Ron Seifert, and I hope I'm saying his name right. Do I have you on the line?
Yes. Hi there.
Ron, are you there? There we go. All right. Did I mangle your last name?
No, you actually got it perfect.
Awesome. So you're actually in Texas right now. You're originally from Montana, if I have my information correct. And you're a climate activist, and we're the media contact for a group that I found down there. We called you today because I wanted to get a little bit of an update. Our listeners in general are going to be very familiar with Keystone XL. We do a lot of coverage on the show up here in Toronto and in Canada in general. People who care about environment issues at all are very familiar with Keystone, but we very rarely get an American perspective, and even more rarely get a perspective of people in the very southern United States. So we're wondering if you could just give us a little bit of an update about some of the actions that your group is taking and some of the recent developments that have been happening down there in the south.
Absolutely. Well, thanks for having me. Unfortunately, I'm probably not the best to give a typical or traditional American perspective on Keystone. It is a very popular project in this country. But here in Texas and Oklahoma, a group is formed called the Tar Sands Blockade, which is a coalition of landowners, community organizers, and environmental and climate justice organizers from across the country. They're coming together to use our collective networks to stop this Keystone XL pipeline. And it is an unusual venue in Texas and Oklahoma, which are the, you know, stalwarts of the oil and gas industry. But, you know, there's a lot of traction for this campaign here. A lot of folks in the South feel very strongly about constitutionally protected land rights and feel that those protections have been violated or disregarded, with a multinational corporation like TransCanada coming through and condemning their property for this pipeline. It's not lost on folks here in the South that this pipeline isn't coming to America. It's just going through America. And people are pretty upset about that. So it's this kind of story of unusual bedfellows, where you have a lot of traditionally conservative folks with traditionally conservative values joining forces with some forced defenders, environmentalists, the direct action community, all working together to stop this pipeline.
Do you find at all in your experience that the environment has been in any way, as per your comment a minute ago there, has been in any way a unifier of the often seen as completely polar, won't even speak to each other, kind of left and right? At least that's the perception that we get on from the media up here in Canada of the sort of Democrats and Republicans, especially during election time. Do you feel like the environment has been in any way a unifier on any of these sort of political disparities?
Well, you know, it is kind of a false dichotomy. I think that it is the case that environmentalist is a dirty word in a lot of the South, but that's not to say that folks don't care deeply and profoundly about their land and conservation. I mean, environmentalism is inherently a conservative philosophy. It's not, you know, that destruction of our ecosystems and our environment and our resources is a very liberal use of them, not a conservative use of resources. So, you know, a lot of folks down here, although it is, like you said, national politics use these labels to kind of make these divisions. But a lot of landowners, ranchers, farmers here in Texas and Oklahoma, they have defining commitments to their land, to their water, to these multi-generational properties. And they know far more about their local ecologies than I would say most self-identified environmentalists in the state. So there's a lot of traction, a lot of common ground there. Folks are very concerned about the risks of such novel tar sands pipeline. Something like this, as I'm sure your listeners know, is untested. A tar sands pipeline of this magnitude, we don't even know how to regulate it in the states. So the regulations don't exist yet. Tar sands is just too new, and people are terrified that in a drought-stricken area, the precious little water resource they have could become contaminated. And there's only a couple aquifers in all of the South that provide drinking water in Texas, for instance, for most of the major cities, and this pipeline is going right over all of them. So if we get aquifer contamination in Texas, you have giant cities like Dallas, Fort Worth, and Houston that could potentially lose their drinking water, or at least have it badly contaminated. So it's a huge threat, and that's not lost on folks down here.
I'm very curious to find out what the sort of strategy then has been along protesting these, with just based on what your just last comment that was there about water supply for major cities. Do you feel like there either has there been already, or do you feel like there could be any traction with state governors or city mayors just on that issue alone to get more of a political movement to oppose this rather than just a grassroots movement? Has that case been made, or could it be made?
You know, it's a difficult struggle. It is certainly an aspiration of a lot of folks working on this in government here in Texas and in the South in general. But, you know, the oil and gas industry has, you know, been the dominating force and really ruled with an iron fist in Texas and Oklahoma for well over a century now. So there's a lot of political inertia when it comes to trying to resist these industries, and there's a lot of regulators, and especially here in Texas, most regulators are appointed by the governor rather than elected. So you have folks like the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality is headed by three individuals that are just appointed by Governor Rick Perry, so they're pretty much industry people, and it's pretty hard to petition them to do the right thing, and that's kind of how we've gotten to this place of using civil disobedience and direct action. Folks have been trying to fight this using the institutions for years now. Your listeners probably know that, you know, Keystone XL has been on the map for over 4 years now. It hasn't been a big sensationalized story for that long, but TransCanada was in Texas in 2008 trying to get property, condemning land, telling ranchers that they were going to build this pipeline whether they liked it or not. So people have been petitioning their local representatives, their government, attending public hearings, doing everything they really could to stop this thing, to protect themselves and defend their homes. And they were just largely ignored. All those legitimate concerns fell on deaf ears. So this is a very rational next step, to actually physically defend your property, to physically blockade this pipeline that is a threat to our collective future. And for a lot of folks down here, they feel like their constitutional rights are being violated and their homes are literally being taken away from them.
This sounds very reminiscent, actually. One of my favorite documentaries over the past few years has been Gasland. And it sounds very familiar, issues going on here. We've only got about a minute left, but I would love to have you on the line for longer. I can think of a number of more questions. Maybe we'll have you back another time. But in just a minute or so we've got left on the program, you know, we've got Canadians who are concerned and upset about this issue up here. We've got people all over the U.S. who are concerned about it. What's the best way forward as far as working together and helping each other, both Canadians and Americans who are opposed to this project? How can we combine our efforts? Is there something you would suggest is the most likely area of traction for this issue?
Well, certainly we really have to draw a line in the sand with tar sands and start working from there. The Houston industrial petrochemical industrial complex is one of the largest in the world, and it's not going to be disassembled or moved dramatically in a short period of time. But we all know that tar sands is this exotic form of energy that we cannot accept. To piggyback on the conversation of your last caller, we don't have the carbon budget for tar sands. We can't just allow this energy source to come online regardless of how it could be used in the developing world and how the export market demands its use. We have to say enough is enough, that communities in Texas and in Alberta that are suffering the worst impacts of this are, you know, have been a sacrifice zone for far too long. That's just a human rights abuse we have to say no to. And we basically just have to draw this line and say tar sands is too far. We can't do it. It's just not okay, and we have to do whatever it takes to stop pipelines like Keystone that will open the floodgates to the further exploitation of tar sands in Alberta.
Absolutely. Well, I'm afraid I'm going to have to stop it there, but thank you so much for joining us today, Ron Seifert.
Hey, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right, so we're out of time, folks. Thank you very much for joining us. I've been Darren Kaster. You have been listening to The Green Majority. I want to thank all our guests today, Dr. Kathy Vackel at the beginning, talking about policy ignoring industry standards for Darlington and other nuclear power plants. We also had Gordy Warnoff, who is the host of Junk Raiders on Discovery Canada. And then we just spoke there to Ron Seifert, who's down in Texas as part of the Blockade Keystone XL group. Thank you much for so much for listening to The Green Majority. I also want to thank Leah Mazzolini and Kevin Farmer for joining us today, Michael McDougall for being on the tech board. And have yourselves a great week, and we'll see you next week. Thanks so much.